Want to know more about queer leadership? Get your copy of Forging Queer Leaders, How the LGBTQIA+ Community Creates Impact from Adversity, by Liz Cavallaro and Bree Fram, releasing May 21st, 2024, in print and audiobook wherever books are sold. The book explores the unique and inspiring developmental experiences of LGBTQ+ leaders, the amazing capabilities they bring to teams, and what that means for everyone pursuing positive and inclusive organizational strategy. With stories from the armed forces, lawyers, entrepreneurs, authors, academics, thought leaders, medical professionals, you name it, this book shows how queer folk everywhere are harnessing their hard-won power and resilience to excel. The book is an essential resource for LGBTQ+ individuals, allies, advocates, business professionals, and leaders of all kinds. Get 20% off if you use the code QueerLeaders20 at jkp.com. To learn more about the book and our upcoming events, please visit us at forgedinfire.org.
Welcome to Season 2 of Forged in Fire, where we explore LGBTQ+ leadership with guests from all over the world. You'll hear as they share how they navigated their journey through crucible experiences to develop into amazing leaders. Forged in Fire is hosted by Colonel Bree Fram and Dr. Liz Cavallaro.
Hi, I'm Bree Fram, an astronautical engineer in the U.S. Space Force. I'm passionate about building the leaders of tomorrow and learning about what the LGBTQ+ leaders of today can teach us.
And I'm Dr. Liz Cavallaro. I'm an adult development scholar and associate professor at the U.S. Naval War College. I'm also an experienced researcher, interviewer, leader development practitioner, and professional executive coach. Please join us as we discover the inspiring stories of how LGBTQ+ leaders are forged.
Welcome to Forged in Fire. Today, we are so excited to be joined by Jude Harris. Jude is a producer and development executive, and as executive director of film and television for Hearst Magazines, she oversees a slate of IP from brands including Cosmo, Elle, Esquire, Men's Health, and Harper's Bazaar in partnership with scripted, documentary, and unscripted filmmakers and production companies. As a producer of documentary films, her credits include David Siebes' Oscar shortlisted documentary Bad Acts, Vikram Gandhi's Hulu original 69, The Saga of Danny Hernandez, and Amy Adrian's Starz film Half the Picture. Prior to her role at Hearst Magazines, Harris worked as Senior Vice President of Development and Production at Gunpowder and Sky and Vice President of MTV's digital studio MTV. Harris's most recent short film as co-writer and director, Funny Face, premiered at South by Southwest 2023 and played at over a dozen film festivals. The film is an autobiographical dramedy co-written with her partner Krista, their second film collaboration together. It follows Jude's own family during a key part of her transition journey. Jude, we are so excited to have you here, and also as a contributor to our book, Forging Queer Leaders, we couldn't wait to have you on the show to talk about your leadership journey. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for including me in the book. It's an honor.
Of course. So great to have you here, Jude. So speaking of your recent short film, Funny Face, what was it like for you to go back and revisit and also reshape this piece of your history for, and also for you and your brother and your partner to play yourselves in doing so?
It's funny. I think that, so Funny Face, for those who haven't seen it, which is most people on planet Earth, it's the story of my facial feminization surgery, which is a 10-hour procedure in which your face is removed from your skull, everything's reshaped and reattached, and it's a bit of a grueling recovery. I think for me, that was the first time in my life that my old understanding of family with my brother and my new understanding of family with my partner and chosen family and kind of the ways that life looked post-transition came together. So even when it was happening the first time, I think we all knew that there was something special going on. And, you know, we would joke on text message, oh, who's going to play us in the movie version of this Texas country singer meeting this Bay Area queer stand-up comic while her girlfriend is a vegetable and everybody's like getting high and watching Face Off. So I think to be able to return to that as a family and tell the story, really, I think giving everyone an equal seat at the table and not having it just center my experience, which candidly my experience was as a piece of furniture, but to give equal weight to my brother who doesn't fully understand my journey as a trans woman, to my partner who was actually having an awesome day at the time and was on her own journey. And even to this, I'd say, very unaware of trans etiquette nurse that I had in real life. I think it felt really healing and it helped shape my approach to storytelling going forward in that I think I was so defensive early in transition that I was really looking for a clear line between the good guys and the bad guys. And I think that helped me to express that, you know, we're all on our own path. And some of the people who have been the most aggravating to me along the way weren't doing it out of any kind of malice. They were carrying their own burdens.
It sounds like it was a bit of a way to really own your story and for the others that were part of it to own their pieces of the story. But you didn't start telling this story until what for many people think is later in life. You didn't come out until you were in your 40s. What was it that led you to come out at that point in your life? Or what it was it that held you back from coming out until you reached that point?
This is so funny because I feel like the guests on this podcast tend to be so buttoned up. But it's really messy. Actually, I was entirely unaware that I was trans. So I was never closeted. I just didn't know. In my 40s, I had a wonderful year where I had the first film I produced at Sundance and, went on to reprise at South By and we sold it to Stars. I had my first TV show that I created on television, owned a house in LA, have two healthy kids and was miserable. And that was the year where I couldn't pin my misery on any externalities. It's not because I hadn't gotten that promotion or I didn't have enough money or, you know, whatever tangible thing would supposedly make me happier. So for the first time in my life, I tried, psychedelic mushrooms, and through a series of happenstances, in that journey, watched the FX television series Pose, which is loosely based on Paris is Burning and documents trans women in the 80s. And for the first time, saw myself in these women and really thought, oh my God, I'm having a bad trip that I think that I'm trans. A week later, took an equally strong dose of mushrooms and watched the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie Predator to try and get back into my masculinity. And when that didn't work, I quickly accepted that I was trans. And, you know, I think because I hadn't been in the shame of decades in the closet, came out to my wife a month later, came out to most of my friends a few weeks after that. And was able to confidently say, look, I know that this is who I am. And, you know, as much as I fear what's about to happen next, I know that it's what has to happen next.
So you had to get to the choppa that was going to take you to being a trans woman.
Oh, yes.
And I have no capability to do an Arnold whatsoever, but that's the Predator.
That's Predator, yeah, to get memory. To the chopper.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what you were going for. It wasn't too bad. So, Jude, you mentioned a moment ago that experience of kind of looking for the bad guys versus the good guys and needing to understand that and be able to draw that line as you went through those periods of your transition. I know that when you first started transitioning, you also got well-meaning advice from some folks, being warned about losing connection with your biological family, but then the quote, good news that you would find your chosen family. And that I know was was meant to be comforting. But that idea is challenging. And that idea that you'd get a chosen family, but lose that connection. How did that impact you?
You know, I think there was a year that was really hard and really sad and was made no better by, and I don't think I'm alone in this. I've subsequently encountered all kinds of middle-aged trans women who really have a dramatic year of just wallowing in everything that they've lost. And I think, you know, I spent a good period of time focusing on the ways that my identity was no longer compatible with all the things I valued in my life. And I had lots of good cries over that. And then, you know, I think at some point you have to keep going. I don't know. I was dumb and slow, and it took me a really long time to see all the things that remained. And that includes like my relationship with my children. You know, I think a very healthy co-parenting relationship with my ex, my relationship with most of my colleagues, my relationship with all my kids, like friends' parents. But yeah, there was a year of really hearing like, oh, you're going to lose family, but you're going to get chosen family instead, where, you know, that felt like, you know, we've got whatever at home. Like I don't want the bad version of family. I want the real thing. And, you know, chosen family showed up for me in very real, profound ways, life-saving ways in that year. And, you know, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't particularly for, you know, my best friend in the world, who is like a trans goat farmer in upstate New York, who talked me through some of the hardest moments of my transition. But, you know, I think I needed to feel my feelings and have my, you know, multi-month temper tantrum before I could really accept and see the gifts that I'd been given.
You said something that I want to dive into deeper in there. You said that there are parts of your identity that were no longer compatible with what you valued in life. And in our book, we talk a little bit about the challenge so many people have in letting go and what that can mean to be able to let go of the things that either we as queer people have internalized from society or other people's hopes and dreams for us. What are some of those things that you had to let go of in order to move forward in your journey?
I mean, I think the most important one was my family as a nuclear family. And I think it was inconceivable to me, and I think this is true for all kinds of people who go through divorce, it's not unique to the transition experience, but it was really, I couldn't imagine a life where it wasn't the four of us. And I think that was the hardest thing to grapple with was, you know, and I currently, my kids live across the country from me and I have them on the holidays and summers. And if I had told myself in my year of sadness and self-pity that that's how it was going to end up, I don't think I could have processed that. In real life, you know, there's FaceTime. We all learned how to communicate across video through the pandemic. And I have an incredibly close relationship with my sons. And, you know, I've explicitly asked them, would you rather have had the old understanding of our family with me as like an eternally grumpy man, or this version of our family where you don't see me as much, but we talk every day and you have me happy and showing up for the relationship as a whole person. And unequivocally, you know, very early in this process, you know, even when they were in the middle of dealing with all the things kids deal with in divorce, they said that they were just so happy to see me happy and that they wouldn't have had me go back to the old version of myself for anything. So, you know, that was one. I think while I wasn't fully aware that I was queer growing up, I grew up in Texas. And I was like, I'm Gen X. So I was like very much a latchkey kid. My dad was not a particularly Texan guy. He's alive. He's still not a particularly Texan guy. So I spent a lot of time really learning how to be a certain kind of man, and I got really, really good at it. You know, I had a big beard and shaved head and wore cowboy boots all the time. And that felt really safe to me. And, you know, I was like, there's nowhere I can't go. There's no one I can't talk to. I have authority wherever I go. I feel safe wherever I go. And that was, it was scary to me to understand, okay, you're going to have to walk away from this, you know. And I think, look, I'm a film producer. My life isn't physically scary ever. It's not, I'm never under any kind of threat, but, you know, to go from the safety of being that kind of alpha male to the total unknown of, you know, being somebody who, you know, my perception, because I had a lot of internalized transphobia, was, okay, I'm going to like being the worst kind of person. And you know, again, my entire career was built on being one kind of person. And I was like, well, this must be the end, right? How will I be able to operate in my career when I can't pull any of the levers I've pulled for the last two decades? And you know, again, that was a fiction, that was fear. But that was certainly the void I was staring into when I figured it all out.
So you gave up the safety of having been able to live that kind of life and show up as that kind of quote man. You gave up the privilege of being a white male, and you gave up a bunch of levers that you had been able to pull for years and have that support your career. And you've mentioned that both your origins and your look don't fit most people's expectation of an executive. Even in the relatively relaxed atmosphere of entertainment, this still doesn't quite fit. But how do you navigate that, or maybe even leverage that now in your leadership?
You know, I think once I let go of, oh, woe is me, I'm not like beardy alpha bro anymore. There's, you know, and I'm a tactician only in that my job in the world is to get stories told and to support artists, and to, you know, get things made in a time where it's really hard to get film and TV made. I think there's a way that you enter a conversation as that like alpha bro, that everyone's prepared for. And you know, you all play three steps ahead in that chess game, and you know, like, the alpha bro is going to enter the conversation this way, and you know, other folks in the conversation will respond as they do, and there's an algorithm to the way those things go. When I let go of that, I think it was really freeing to enter conversations and realize, wow, nobody has any idea what to do with me. And I really, this sounds cynical, and I hope it's not cynical, but that can be leveraged, like to be a total unknown. There's a certain kind of power in that. And there's a certain kind of, even when dealing with people who I suspect are transphobic, I think that whatever I've lost in hierarchical privilege, I've gained something in, you don't know what to expect from this tattooed transsexual who you're on a Zoom with or in a meeting with, who may bring you a certain amount of discomfort, but, you know, is also bringing you a film that will hopefully make you money, or an opportunity that will hopefully change your career. I think embracing it has become a strength.
So as far as strengths go, it sounds like embracing change and leveraging that change is one that is right up your alley. And while the whole world has changed dramatically, I can imagine the entertainment world has too in the past several years. And you have to assemble different groups of talented people to make these pitches for the shows and movies that you're working on. You've probably got six or seven or more different projects working at once. So you're really operating in this uncertain, complex world that requires change and change management all the time. Are there particular skills you use to be effective in such a dynamic environment?
I mean, I think, you know, it's not just not resisting change. I think it's also accepting the way things are. And, you know, everything that's happening in the world at large and in entertainment specifically is upsetting and destabilizing. But, you know, you have to show up every day and figure out what projects are going to move forward and what things you're going to work on and make choices about what you think can succeed. I think being able to embrace, okay, this is, look, we're in a strike year. Look, AI is taking over. Look, media is getting more conservative. And say, okay, well, like, let's just accept those as the facts of the situation rather than trying to resist in a way that layers the complicated project of getting a film made or a work of art made with the complicated project of dismantling, you know, the challenges of late stage capitalism. You know, I think I'm always looking for, okay, where does the Venn diagram align? Where is the surfable wave? Where is the thing that we can move forward? And, you know, hope that I'm picking things and I'm picking people who kind of Trojan horse their way through that reality. That, look, I don't want to, if this is, for instance, a year in media where it seems that the odds are stacked against queer stories. You know, I think until there's a presidential election this year and everybody understands kind of the general course of culture in the United States, I don't think we're going to see big queer stories being told on the streamers. They're all, I think, both financially conservative and also socially somewhat conservative right now. You can fight that. You can pitch them 99 different trans shows and they can pass on them all. Or you can look for ways to put queer artists and trans artists into stories that they will say yes to. So I think... And I think there's valid criticism for my methodology. But I think that's the path that I've really taken since, you know, the current version of myself in my career is, look, let's embrace what is and do as much as we can in that environment.
So in that environment, all of the complexity and unpredictability and tons of seemingly insurmountable challenges or just barriers thrown in your way that many are experiencing as this is just impossible. We're not going to be able to get through this. What have you learned from your transition journey or maybe your engagements with the other queer folks that you've worked with in the industry about that has impacted the way in which you face a seemingly insurmountable challenge?
You know, my favorite co-conspirators really have a foot in the history of, you know, Jackie Shane being a trans singer in the 50s and 60s and, you know, the queer history of Brooklyn and, you know, all the queer-coded stuff in Hollywood that happened even, you know, in the Hays Code days that, you know, I think you can always look back and see the path. You can always look at the thing that worked and, you know, like our community is more resourceful and, you know, I think in a really delightful way that should be celebrated, opportunistic and able to make something out of nothing that, you know, I mean, whether it's like friends in the ballroom scene or friends that have been doing like queer community theater since the 80s, there's always that, okay, you know, we have two nickels and a dime and we're trying to pull something off. And there's almost always a historical precedent.
I've been trying to formulate a question since you talked about working through late stage capitalism and getting stories told. And I recently read a book about techno-feudalism saying capitalism is over and instead we're operating in a world where we have these cloud fiefdoms where everyone has to pay rent to work in one of these arenas, whether that's the closed network of one of the distributors like a Netflix, or that's, you know, we're all creating content for free for Facebook and TikTok and others. How do you, in this kind of new world, as you said, figure out what those stories are that you can insert trans or queer themes into? What are the pragmatic things we have to do to operate in this world to make sure that representation is still there and it still matters? Because we've seen so many times how often trans people have been portrayed as tricksters or the villain. How do we get them into those roles where they're not, where they are just like anyone else, doing the same jobs and having the same hopes and dreams as everybody else?
I think that's a big question. This reference is now problematic, but I'm still waiting for the trans Cosby show, where it's just incidental to the story. And, you know, for all of his deep, deep, horrible faults, you know, Bill Cosby changed the perception of Black American families through television. And we haven't seen that yet. I think it's been great to see some of the roles that Patty Harrison gets that aren't, you know, trading on her transness. I think Hunter Schafer's celebrity is going to pay dividends in big ways, that she's normalized the idea of, you know, a trans girl in high school being desirable and fun and cool and, you know, not a trickster, and certainly not like the trans women I saw in like Boys Don't Cry and the things that I saw in the 90s. But, you know, I think it's going to be chipping away at it and trying things. And, you know, for all the techno-feudalism stuff, I think there's going to be some portion of the audience that's like, look, I work a long week and I'm tired and I want to be entertained, and I will watch what Netflix suggests I watch in the genres that I like. I think there's going to be some portion of the audience that responds to things like what A24 has done and making independent films feel very special and like a piece of cultural currency. And, you know, if you look at the frenzy in the sapphic community around Love Lies Bleeding, or, you know, what they were able to do with Moonlight, you know, that prestige still matters. So it's going to be probably a combination of, all right, how do I get Patty Harrison into more roles or other actors into more roles in mainstream shows where they perhaps won't be the lead? And then how do I increase the prestige side of trans storytelling? You know, I think Trace Lissette's recent, you know, unfortunately failed, but Oscar hopeful run at, for Monica is a good example of that. You know, I think it's chipping away at High and Low until you get to that mainstream show that's, you know, Trans Will and Grace, Trans Modern Family. And knowing that the cavalry is coming and that there's a whole generation of kids for whom this is like nothing at all. And a whole generation of older cishet white executives that will be retiring in the next 10 to 20 years.
So speaking of the sort of face of executives changing, one of the projects that you worked on was a documentary that explored discriminatory hiring practices concerning women directors in Hollywood, and also looking at those that have succeeded against the odds. When you worked on that project, what did you learn from those women that translates over to LGBTQ leadership in Hollywood?
You know, I think the real lesson there is, you know, and the numbers of women directors are still dismal in Hollywood. I believe they took another dip last year in feature film releases, and some of that is tied to the strike and releases overall diminishing. So, you know, half the picture is the film you're talking about. And we talked to so many incredible women. And I think largely the successful strategy for all of them was to build their own thing. I mean, whether it's Penelope Spheeris, who, you know, made her name, you know, in rock and roll with the Decline of Western Civilization series of just incredible super punk music docs, and then made her career with the Wayne's World movie, you know, or Ava DuVernay, who's built a whole industry around her success, you know, initially as a publicist and then as a director and producer. You know, I think we're just going to see more and more people get enough power to build their own things. Like, you know, Reese Witherspoon has done that. You know, I think a lot of actors are doing that. And I think, you know, directors are catching up. They're always a little bit less powerful. You know, I think the lesson there, as much as it's, you know, seeing what entrepreneurial people have been able to build despite the odds stacked against them, has been how much is left on the table by an industry that looks at a population that's 50% female and says, let's make a majority of male films as content and male series as content. You know, not only is that a jerk move, but that's leaving a significant share of the audience on the table and unclaimed. I think, you know, if you look at the makeup of most films that get made, I mean, if the demographics of the United States, we should be seeing significantly more Latino films, and we're not seeing that, despite the fact that demographically they represent a significantly larger portion of the population than is ever portrayed in mainstream media. So, you know, I think as an individual filmmaker, that's always hugely frustrating, and it's frustrating to be a member of any marginalized community and say, okay, my opportunities are being limited by systemic racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, etc. Ableism, certainly, probably more than any other category in media. But, you know, there's also that chance on the other side to do what Margot Robbie did with Barbie, and, you know, to make these films that, you know, overperform because the audiences are underserved. So, you know, the queer community doesn't have the capital of some of these other marginalized communities. And certainly, you know, I don't think anybody's going to get rich making trans films for 0.5% of the population. That being said, if you look at the demographics of Gen Z and whatever we're calling the people at the youngest edge of that, or whatever the next generation is, you know, I think it's just understanding that the guys in the big chairs are wrong, and that there's not only artistic success to have on a personal level, but there's audience out there with money to spend that is being ignored and will be engaged if they're given something to engage with.
Yeah, with now 30% of young Gen Z folks identifying as LGBTQ, there's that desire to see representation, see someone that looks like them across all their intersectional identities everywhere. And we've touched a little bit already on, you know, the fact that representation matters, but so often that's held back by those senior executives that are still running things today. You said, hey, a lot of them are going to retire in the next 10 or 20 years, but what do we need to do now to prepare those future queer and otherwise representative executives to step into those roles and make that type of impact that we want them to?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, there are a very small number of trans executives. There's a much larger number of queer executives. I think it's a numbers game. I think, you know, we need more, and I'm not allowed to talk about this. I just heard of a really exciting scholarship at a major school designed for LGBTQ kids, but you know, there, I think as a community, we may need to do a better job of providing, there's something very warm and fuzzy about providing support for artists. And I love artists, and I'm an artist, and I love providing support for artists. And like, that's a defining quality of my career. But, you know, we need more trans entertainment attorneys. We need more trans studio heads. We need more trans agents and managers. We need, I think, we often forget that there's like a whole machine around, you know, all of the arts, music, fine art, film and television, theater, et cetera. And I don't know that I'm the person to do it, but maybe when we reach that critical mass of folks, you know, a little bit more on the business side, a little bit more on the white collar side of these industries, you know, they'll be in line for the throne. I mean, right now we just don't have that many people who are in that world. That being said, it's encouraging to me how many queer people, largely cis gay men. But I think we're seeing, you know, more cis lesbians, and, you know, the trans community is catching up in proximity to power. You know, will shareholders anoint them? Will those people, you know, trans folks with money, queer folks with money should be, you know, investing and asking questions about the companies that they hold shares in. But, you know, it's slow. We don't have a lot of money. We don't have a lot of power. And I think it's just going to take time, and it's going to take finding those who have the appetite for the work outside of the spotlight to move ahead.
In preparation for today's discussion, you shared with us that you were curious about how trans executives or entrepreneurs in other industries are gaining success and what kind of strategies they're using that are effective to move forward in their industries. And you mentioned a moment ago the women in Hollywood who had found success. It was because they created their own thing and they found something that wasn't being done by the majority, but that there was an audience out there for. I'm wondering what you see as being sort of the version of that for others in the community, perhaps not in Hollywood, but in other sectors, right? What is it that they can be creating that is unique and original and that there's a market for as a strategy to move forward in their industries?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. I think, you know, there are more of us attaining some kind of celebrity. And, you know, I think Elliot Page has a production company and has fame and has done a really admirable job at marrying his activism with his celebrity, with his talent as an author, and creating something bigger. I think it's looking for those places where, and there's, you know, all kinds of like wonderful trans startups that are like serving the trans community. I'm always looking for the places of, you know, within entertainment, because that's my world and that's all I think about, or the majority of what I think about, is looking at the places where our strengths as a community or the idiosyncrasies of our stories or the things that are funny or relatable overlap with a larger need for a certain kind of storytelling, general relatability, et cetera. So I think it's that, you know, being specifically trans, and I think being queer in any way is somewhat isolating, and it's easy to say, okay, look, I'm concerned about myself and people like me and my community. And Lord knows enough time and energy goes into serving the cis world. but I think finding those places where you can serve both is probably where you're going to win, just because we're outnumbered. So again, you know, I think Patty Harrison and Shrill, I think Hunter Schafer and Euphoria are examples of, look, let's create cultural moments that are largely driven by a cast that's bigger than, you know, like significantly larger than its trans representation, but still, you know, it's put a trans drummer in your band, like put a trans COO. in your C-suite, those things where, you know, I think that will naturally start to coalesce power.
So you're on this leading edge of having trans executives show up in spaces where they aren't expected. You talked about that earlier, that you're the wild card. There's no script that's been written for how someone interacts with you in these spaces. Now, that's difficult. That can be really tiring and a lot of work to figure out on your end how you navigate some of those things. What do you do to stay resilient through those moments where you're thrown some of those wild cards back at you, or you receive what is clearly bias or discrimination? Because that's tough to persevere through. What keeps you going?
I think, you know, and again, this took a really long time, but I think now I feel that I'm at such an advantage to be engaging in conversations at an extremely high level of authenticity, that, you know, I try to focus on the ways that I'm free to be fully myself while doing my job. And that, you know, I think we underestimate how many cishet people are out there feeling very constrained by gender roles or expectations or cliches about how they should behave in their position. So, you know, if somebody says something that's out of pocket or dumb or, you know, slightly offensive, I think, you know, 2-3 years ago, I would have been much more inclined to have big feelings about it and, you know, say something or, you know, write the HR email or whatever. But now I think, you know, it's easier to just let it go because, and I'm not, you know, I'm not just saying this. I mean, certainly it's not fun to encounter transphobia, but at the same time, I think 9 times out of 10, I'm sitting in my power and the other person is sitting in, you know, some kind of prejudice or some kind of, you know, figuring themselves into a hierarchy that has very little to do with the conversation at hand. So, you know, it happens, but I think so rarely that I'm more focused on, okay, you know, take a deep breath before the Zoom, take a deep breath before the pitch, and bring yourself fully into the conversation. Because I don't think I've ever felt like anyone who's engaging with me fully as an individual has been offensive. It's only when they've been engaging with stereotypes about what my community is like. So I don't know, more often than not, I just feel like I carry my own power with me.
That theme of being able to show up fully and be authentic, it's interesting because you talked about that earlier in the family life with your kids, of being able to have this parent that was showing up fully, and then how important that is in a professional setting to be able to be authentic and bring more to the table. What is the superpower in that that makes you effective as a leader?
I mean, I think we all desire that. I mean, self-actualization is at the top of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And I'm blanking on the book. I think it may be called Transitions or something, but it's not about trans stuff. It's a revisitation of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, restating that self-actualization isn't the cherry on top. It's actually the goal. And I think that we all, you know, work, engage in conversation, engage in relationships, whether personal or professional, when everyone can show up and be fully seen. And, you know, I think it's this weird thing where it's like we all need to feel seen and special for a moment. And then if we're going to get anything done, we need to let go of that and focus on the task at hand. But I think it's contagious in a really wonderful way. I think that if you're showing up and being yourself, that inherently gives everyone else permission to do the same. And, you know, earlier in this process, and, you know, I've only been transitioning for 5 years, I think that came with a lot of fear of, like, you know, well, what if I show up with my authentic self and somebody else, like, shows up and their authentic self is just, you know, bad or gross or mean or whatever. But I don't think anybody's like that, truly. I mean, I think even some of the most adversarial people, if you say, look, I'm showing up fully as myself, in the way you carry yourself and in the way that you bring yourself to a conversation, if they actually can meet you in kind and mirror that, it's going to be great. Like, yes, there's plenty of people who have a wall of cynicism that they'll never let down or, you know, a need to be oppositional or game the system or whatever. But, yeah, I don't know. I think my Pollyanna belief is that if you can get somebody to fully be themselves, like, you'll have the best interaction that, you know, two humans or a group of humans can have.
Jude, you were kind enough to write a story for Forging Queer Leaders that we ended up selecting as the epilogue of the book because it was so powerful and so effectively captured all of the themes that we wanted to share and we think the stories of queer leaders really do hit on. Now, we don't want to spoil that story. We hope people will read that in the book, but it was really about a friend of yours and how he supported you as an ally. And, you know, there's goats involved, but not the goat anyone is thinking of in this case. But we wanted to ask, would you talk a bit about the importance of allyship and share any advice you might have for our listeners who want to show up for the community?
Yeah, I mean, and really friendship, like that's such a deep friendship. You know, I'm trying, how do I tell this story without spoiling it? My best friend in the whole world is a trans goat farmer in, you know, the middle of nowhere in New York. And we were introduced by a mutual cishet friend of ours who, when I came out, said, "Oh my gosh, you have to meet my other trans friend." And I was so mad because I was like, oh God, now I'm one of these people where it's like, oh, I know another trans person. And I called him with the biggest chip on my shoulder and we were immediately friends. And, you know, we were in very similar points in our transition journey. He was a little further along with having figured it all out. But I think just the generosity of, you know, that both of us were able to be honest with each other about, look, I have the emotional bandwidth to take on what you're going through right now. And that, you know, we had, I guess, enough understanding of each other's worlds, but also, like, I don't know anything at all about freaking goat farming. I just know a little bit about like what it's like to be tough and push through things. But yeah, no, he talked me through the hardest things. And, you know, I truly wouldn't be alive if it wasn't for the support that I'd been given in the form of phone calls, in the form of text check-ins, in the form of just a little bit of support. You know, I think the biggest thing that's lacking for those of us who don't kind of enter our adult lives or our careers out, particularly out as trans, is that, you know, it's this rite of passage that we really don't have a societal ritual for. We know what to do if a colleague loses a spouse or is going through a divorce or has a sick child or loses a parent or is having a baby. And I think we collectively sort of know how to step up for that person because we've seen it modeled our entire lives. And, you know, I think for non-queer allies or for, you know, allies within various queer identities, that understanding that that's something that we really need. And that, you know, I think it's hard in a time like in American culture where like, you know, healthcare is so bad and parental leave is so bad and time off is so bad to propose something as audacious as, oh, well, we need time for people to like move through their feelings when they come out in adult life. You know, I think if you'd said that to me a few years ago, I would have a knee jerk kind of how dare you response, like how dare you ask for this when like, you know, so many people get so little, but you know, none of this is a zero sum game. And I think the more space that we can make for understanding each other's struggles and like finding that same kind of, you know, this is just a thing that happens. And when someone is going through this, you know, you need to bring them some food and pick up a little bit of the slack and know that they'll be back better and stronger and happier and wholer, more whole. You know, certainly within the queer community, we need to start building that. And again, I think that's one of those things that when people outside of our community see us showing up for each other and being kind to each other in that way, it's a light bulb moment. And they start to think about the ways that they can take care of each other as well.
Jude, thank you so much for joining us and sharing some of this wisdom. You said something that I'm going to step away with as something incredibly valuable, and that's that people are problematic when they engage with stereotypes. because here we are, as you said, sitting in our own power, in our authenticity, and that's where we need to be. And those stories that you tell, those stories that you help create, help people move away from engaging with stereotypes and help them to engage with individuals. And that is so amazing. So thank you so much for telling and sharing your story and being part not only of this podcast, but also of the book. We're so excited for people to read your story because it really does hit with a lot of emotional impact. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode. The views and ideas expressed by the hosts and guests of this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the organizations or institutions they represent. Forged in Fire is a collective effort brought to you by a fantastic team of passionate individuals. This podcast is produced and engineered by Frida Castellanos, media production by Christina George, operations by Imogene Thomas, and communications by Chelsea Asplund. Brief Ram serves as executive producer and hosts the show along with Dr. Liz Cavallaro. But we couldn't do this without the inspiration provided by LGBTQ+ leaders around the world working hard to build a better future for all. For more information, visit our website at forgedinfire.org.